What do you do internally for yourself when you get shin pot?
I mean, I think it's twofold. Here's the exact moment that I'm dealing with right now in the present, and just make it through that moment without overreacting, without taking things out on other people that I don't mean to. But then there's the second part of it, which is outside of that moment. And it's kind of zooming way out from the moment and reflecting on that. And how did I react? Do I like how I react? Do I want to react that way again? Does it fit into like the bigger puzzle of my life experiences and where I've come from and what I'm bringing to that moment?
Welcome to Jazz Therapy, where we explore the intersectionality of jazz, the psyche and psychoanalytic thought, spirituality, and consciousness. We have in-depth conversations with people from various walks of life, all of whom view their work as a service to humanity. Then we listen to jazz and discuss our thoughts, feelings, and reflections which arise from hearing this incredible art form. I'm your host, Jesse Shapiro. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. If you or someone you know is feeling suicidal or in an emotional crisis, you can call or text the SAMHSA Crisis Line, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Simply call or dial 988 24/7, 365 days a year. My guest today is Dorothy Morrow. Dorothy is a senior interior designer at Lionakis Education Interior Studio with 20 years of experience in commercial and education interior design. She also serves as a board member for River Charter Schools. Her passion is to create next-gen learning environments that reside at the vertex where curriculum, the built environment, and adaptable furniture solutions overlap. Dorothy excels in balancing color, durable finishes, furnishings, lighting, school branding, and teaching on display while maintaining facility budgets. Her goal is to inspire educators, students, administration, and the greater community to take pride in their state-of-the-art facilities and reach their educational goals. Dorothy is also a super mom to three energetic boys aged 8, 9, and 10. She and her partner are the ultimate travel buddies, always ready for an adventure with the boys.
Thank you.
Well, I wanted to start this podcast because I had a spiritual awakening when I was 20. I was going through a great deal of suffering, and this really changed the course of my life. And jazz is also one of my greatest joys in life. And I also really believe in a service to humanity. And sort of the point I want to make with that is just that really any job can be, quote, spiritual. It's really just the attitude that we have going into it, that we want to help people make the world a better place. So that's sort of why we're here. And it is also my hope that jazz can be a way for myself, for you, and for everyone who hears it to be able to experience this beautiful art form and also to get to know themselves on a deeper level, to be able to reflect about what thoughts and feelings and emotions come up as a way to just learn more about themselves. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. And we're just kind of going to ride the wave and see what comes up. And since Dorothy is an interior designer, I was really holding in mind that the theme of today would be beauty in all its many different forms. And so I wanted to read a couple quotes to start us off, and we'll also do some more kind of at the middle of the show. As if you are on fire from within, the moon lives in the lining of your skin. Pablo Neruda. Beauty is not in the face. Beauty is a light in the heart. Cahil Gibran. The beauty of a woman is not in a facial mole, but true beauty in a woman is reflected in her soul. It is the caring that she lovingly gives, the passion that she knows. Audrey Hepburn. People are like stained glass windows. They sparkle and shine when the sun is out, but when the darkness sets in, their true beauty is revealed only if there is a light from within. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So we'll just kind of set the tone with that. And to get started, I wanted to ask you, Dorothy, what spirituality means to you and what that looks like for you in your life?
That's a great question. My spiritual evolution has changed throughout my life. I certainly was raised attending church with my parents and did that through probably my mid-20s. And part of what I did there, you know, part of, I think, what is intriguing about your speaking about beauty and how that evolves in my life, that has also changed over time. And I used to sing a lot and provide beauty in the world through my voice. And that was also a lot wrapped up in the church world. I sang in the church choir. I sang in the gospel choir when I was in college, and kind of enjoyed the group activity of bringing kind of that sound beauty into the world. And then over time kind of explored what spirituality meant to me, not just kind of how I was raised and what I was given in my life. And now I think spirituality for me is kind of taking those moments to reflect on my day and meditate and make sure that I feel grounded and present in my life throughout the day.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're sort of saying your original kind of exposure to spirituality has really been transmuted into, you know, different ways of bringing beauty into your life and then really trying to be as present as possible. Do you associate with any, type of practice or feel called to anything at this point in time?
I think for me, it's just about exploration and constantly thinking about where I am and what I need right now as a mom, as a full-time working mom, as a wife, in all of my roles in life, so that I can kind of get back to my true self and make sure that I don't lose my own identity in the world. But it's really about kind of reflection for me.
There's a Buddhist concept and it's called Shenpa. Have you heard of this concept before?
No, I haven't.
So basically that you could use the word trigger. I'll read you a little definition, and this is from Pema Chodron. The Tibetan word for when we get hooked or triggered is Shenpa. It is usually translated attachment, but a more descriptive translation might be, quote, hooked. When Shenpa hooks us, we're likely to get stuck. We could call Shenpa, quote, that sticky feeling, end quote. It's an everyday experience. Even a spot on your new sweater can take you there. At the subtlest level, we feel a tightening, a tensing, a sense of closing down. Then we feel a sense of withdrawing, not wanting to be where we are. That's the hooked quality. That tight feeling has the power to hook us into self-denigration, blame, anger, jealousy, and other moments which lead to words and actions that end up poisoning us. So basically, it's any time we feel reactive. And I'm curious, what do you do internally when you get hooked? You know, be it work, with your kids. I definitely have to work on this every day. And I'm so curious, because that's really like where our spiritual work is, like day to day, minute to minute, since you're talking about being present and reflective. So what do you do internally for yourself when you get Shin Pot?
I mean, I think it's twofold. Here's the exact moment that I'm dealing with right now in the present and trying to kind of just make it through that moment without overreacting, without taking things out on other people that I don't mean to. But then there's the second part of it, which is outside of that moment. And it's kind of taking a larger, you know, kind of zooming way out from the moment and reflecting on that. And how did I react? Do I like how I react? Do I want to react that way again? Does it fit into like the bigger puzzle of my experience, my life experiences and where I've come from and what I'm bringing to that moment that has nothing to do with that moment, that is just my own reaction or my own experience? And do I like that? Do I want to continue that? You know, it's really kind of that noticing those things and kind of collecting a bunch of them all together and then thinking about them. How did I react? How do I want to react? And then deciding, do I want to react the same way again? Or do I need to go back and talk to a person about how I reacted and, you know, kind of say, hey, I noticed that I did this and I'm not proud of how I reacted. And I think this is what was coming up for me. And trying to kind of address the situation, not be scared of addressing it, which I certainly had to do a lot of work to be able to get through on my own, because I used to avoid those situations a lot.
It does take kind of like a dying to our ego to be able to go and have a conversation like that and apologize while also doing it in a way where, because I know I have had the tendency to do this, where we also don't collapse and be like, I'm a martyr and like, I'm so terrible. Like there's a sweet spot there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, not over addressing every little thing or overreacting to every little bit that happens in the world.
When you do get activated in the moment, is there any self-talk that you do or way that you help yourself? Like if you do get activated, you know, like how do you work with yourself internally in those moments? I'm always so curious as to what everyone is doing.
Yeah. I mean, certainly taking some deep breaths, mm-hmm. that always helps just to kind of give a pause and think before reacting. Yeah, that's probably the biggest thing. It's just taking some deep breaths and a moment.
That is a simple one and it's such a profound one. And I know mm-hmm. there's been times when I've been activated and I'm like, okay, I need to take some deep breaths and I'll still feel like that anger or annoyance or whatever come up and I'll be like taking shallow breaths and I can still see that I'm attached to whatever it is I'm holding on to. And if I really do actually breathe deep, then I can mm-hmm. let it go.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's part of like, okay, did I take the breaths that I needed? Was I able to react appropriately? And I think it's all a practice. And that's a lot of what I try to teach my kids is, you know, we're practicing. We're all practicing. You're practicing. You don't have to get everything right. I think I grew up with a lot of perfectionist tendencies. So if I didn't get things right, then it was, oh, you know, this is terrible. I should have done this some other way and I should have reacted differently. And now I'm able to say, okay, how did I do that time that I practiced? Is that how I wanted to react? Can I do better? Maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe it's just giving myself the grace to say, hey, I handled that the best that I could in the moment. And do I need to do something differently?
That's such beautiful modeling for your children, for them to see you take deep breaths. And then also what you mentioned about going and being able to acknowledge if you make a mistake, since not mm-hmm. only does that really tell your children like you care, of course, and that you are working on growing, it makes it okay for them to see that and then mm-hmm. do the same thing too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, we can tell them all we want for how we want them to react or what we want them to do, but it's really about modeling it for them. That's the only way that it will really feel real for them, feel truthful for them.
Mm-hmm. In terms of your practice of reflection, do you take kind of like a personal inventory at the end of the day every day? Do you do it kind of periodically through your day, through your week? What does that look like?
That waxes and wanes. Again, as a recovering perfectionist, I don't feel like I have to do it this exact way every time. Mm-hmm. I have been doing what I'll call yoga for almost a year. Every day I've done yoga for a year. And a lot of it ends up being that, okay, I'm going to sit at the end of the day and I'm going to do some stretches to make my body feel better, but also just be able to kind of clear my head and be in a calmer moment to kind of think about and address whatever is residing in my body from the day, my mind from the day. And so I think that's probably the most regular practice that I use, but a lot of times it's just, hey, am I having a nagging thought? Is there something that keeps coming up over and over for me? You know, clearly that is something that I need to step back and address. And I do that a lot with just kind of journaling and writing, trying to kind of just get through that thought, because I'll get stuck on a little loop of I'm thinking this thing over and over and over again, and I can't get past that initial what something feels wrong and I'm not quite sure what it is. But if I can kind of write through it, then I'll be able to get on to the next thought and kind of work through some of those thoughts.
I love that. And I love just kind of your attitude, as you said, as a recovering perfectionist, of having your reflective practice just be something that's more in flow rather than that it needs to be structured, and that you can use tools like journaling when you feel called to just kind of have that come up. I also noticed you said that you did yoga every day for the past year. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if you might share with us what that has been like, what you have gotten out of that practice. That's a really lovely dedication to have that consistency.
Yeah, it is. You know, I just kind of started knowing that as I'm getting older, my body doesn't kind of move the same way that it always did. Certainly lingering aches and pains that I know kind of stretching and strength training and making sure that I'm moving in a way that helps my longevity, and kind of just started, you know, no real intention of I'm going to do this every day. But once I had kind of started building the streak, it was, I want to keep this streak going. And I've certainly celebrated milestones. I did my 100th day of yoga in Boston with my best friend in her living room. And, you know, just kind of, and I, one of my other favorite moments was overlooking Denali National Park in Alaska from my hotel room balcony, doing yoga, and, you know, kind of those like, oh, this is a really great moment. And again, enjoying the beauty in those moments and the relationships and the experiences, while also, you know, kind of making sure that I'm continuously keeping up a practice that really feels like this is for me and this makes me feel good. And some days it's 20 minutes in front of the big picture window as the sun rises, and some days it's 10 minutes laying in bed before I go to sleep, just kind of reflecting on the day. And so I think it's, you know, I call it a kind of yoga practice, because a lot of it really is that mindfulness piece of it that I've really gotten out of it.
We are learning a lot already, everybody, and that is flowing with the Tao, which is totally what you're talking about. I love that you're saying you started this yoga practice and it wasn't kind of with this rigidity that you needed to complete a whole year. It was just something that really felt good and was nourishing to you. And that gave mm-hmm. you the natural momentum to keep going with it in a variety of beautiful settings, and that you're able to be flexible about it. What have you learned about yourself through this practice?
Yeah, I think I've learned that I think that I have become the recovering perfectionist that I've wanted, right? That I'm able to kind of do something I really set my mind to, even if I'm not quite sure what the end result is going to be. And that's something that often really terrifies me, is I want to know what the end result is going to be so I can kind of move towards that goal. And I get nervous of making the wrong move or kind of taking steps down a path or in a direction that I don't know what the end result is going to be. But this is certainly kind of a coin in the piggy bank of I can do these things, and I can prove to myself that doing something for just me is really valuable, and will really make me proud of myself, give me that moment to reflect and kind of spiral a lot of things out of just a really simple practice like this.
Well, uncertainty is the hardest to bear for all of us. I feel that myself. I always tell clients that in psychotherapy, and I completely understand what you mean. And I hear you saying, I think at a deeper level, this has been a way for you to step into sort of more uncertainty and not really know where things are going to go, and just be able to embrace that, and that's mm-hmm. been really nourishing for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's an exploration. I think one of my favorite words, favorite passion words in life is exploration. And it's really about, you know, kind of going off into the unknown or saying, I want to go on an adventure today and I want to experience new things. And so it's certainly, I can see those milestones in that I mentioned of practicing with a friend or practicing in a new place. And kind of proving to myself I can keep doing it and really relish in those moments.
Exploration without perfection, exploration in flow and harmony. I love mm-hmm. that.
Yep.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your work as a designer and beauty. You mentioned that, you know, beauty was in your life from an early age in a vocal way where you were sharing your gifts with the world. I wonder if you could just talk about beauty and how it has come into your life, you know, from when you were small to how it got you to become a designer, sort of like what the call to that was, you know, looking back in the trajectory of your life. Mm-hmm. It's a big question. So
yeah,
we'll just kind of roll with it all.
Let's see. Well, I knew that I wanted to be an interior designer because I loved art. I loved creating and math. And so I definitely I'm more of an analytical designer. I like thinking about how people use a space and how people will flow through the world the built world that I'm helping to create, versus, you know, kind of just thinking about here are the needs of the program of the project that I'm working on. It's how do we think about it? How is somebody walking in the front door of this space, of this building, and what is their experience like as they enter the building? If it's the first time they've been there, if it's somewhere they visit regularly, like a school that I work on, you know, what is a one-time visitor's experience? What is a student's experience? What is a teacher's experience in the space? And how can they not only enjoy being there, want to come back to the space, want to experience it again, kind of exploring, and how do they experience it in different ways at different times that they've come into the space or used the space, as a, if you will.
Well, I hear you saying that beauty needs to be functional, sort of in the way that you're holding it, that you're really thinking about, we are people, and especially in a school setting, that it's a used space for a specific purpose, and that you're really holding that in mind is how does this really work?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm thinking about a project that I helped with. I was not the sole designer on, but my team worked on it. And it was a science building for a high school campus. And the design concept we created together was the building as a prism, like all of how all of the colors can kind of interact and overlap to create new colors, and how that evolves throughout the day. You know, if you think about a small prism hanging in your window, that it doesn't shine rainbows on the room all day long, but at a certain time of the day, the sun will be just right that now all of a sudden your room is filled with rainbows and you can see them everywhere and experience that maybe for just a minute or two, but, you know, just kind of taking the step back and being in awe of that moment as it comes, and kind of the reminder in that moment to be present and enjoy what you see. I think I do that a lot throughout my day. I notice whenever I'm driving my son to school, certain times of the year, there are these beautiful sunrises, and I am constantly pointing them out to him. And he started pointing them out back to me, but, you know, just, hey, you know, this could be just a humdrum moment, but why don't we step back and really kind of say, look at the beautiful sunrise, and just, you know, again, take some deep breaths and just enjoy that moment and experience that for what it is.
Oh, I love that, because on so many levels, you already have an orientation to the world to notice beauty, and you're helping your son do that, and he's taking that in. And then I think at a deeper level, I also hear you say those moments become small moments of gratitude. I think mm-hmm. I hear that under, like, mm-hmm. because I'm just so glad to be able to take in with my eyes this beautiful sunrise right now, or this sunset.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's a huge part of it, right? Of kind of enjoying the world and being present, is being able to relish those really tiny moments.
I noticed when you were talking about the concept that you and your team had come up with of the prism for the science building, I just want to say that is so amazing. We are all so affected by our environments, and the fact that you all are holding in your mind, how can we make environments for students more beautiful so that they can learn more? I wonder if you could kind of talk about how you even approach a new project when you do that. Like, I think I would just feel totally overwhelmed. And yet we're also affected by beautiful spaces. Like, we all would want our children to be in a lovely space where they can learn, absorb, explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, every project is so completely different. If we're working, that project was a single building on an existing campus. And so there's always the, we want this to feel like it belongs on this campus, but also, you know, thinking about, again, how the people that are visiting the building experience the space on a day-to-day basis, and maybe that one time a year where another really cool moment in that science building. We put colored fins on the windows in an arrangement. And on the wall, there's a graphic that's this equation. And it just comes to equals. And so, you know, there's this whole equation and it may not make complete sense. It doesn't really spell out exactly what it is unless you know. And then there's certain time of the year, again, where the sun is coming in perfectly. So those colored fins shine E equals MC squared on the wall. And that I believe happens in the springtime. And so a student may come through the building, you know, for the first semester, for most of the second semester, and then these probably 2 weeks during the year, you can see E equals MC squared and kind of the result is revealed to you of what this equation means. And so, you know, that's that kind of teaching on display and that piece of it kind of evolves over time where we're creating the design concept and the space and, you know, working in school design is a really interesting balance between durability of finishes and budgets. You know, as we all know, teachers are underpaid and school facilities, especially in the public school environment that I work in, there's only so much funding to go around for those and a mountain of code requirements and needs of space and use of space. So those little kind of jewel moments really are even more extra special when we're able to get those into projects.
That was so lovely the way you described in the spring with the design that you did. I could just imagine, I sort of saw this play out in my mind, like a student walking through this building and maybe it's something they see every day. And then the light is just so, and they can see all that beauty come in and just, it's, I would pause. I would imagine them pausing and just kind of taking that in, that the design and the beauty that you're trying to impart in different settings is a gift that kind of almost keeps on giving. Like it's like a surprise almost. Mm-hmm. And maybe on a deeper level too, it mirrors the bloom in spring that we see.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's my favorite of when we can kind of create those moments that do evolve over time, or that, you know, teachers can use if we put the Fibonacci sequence, you know, in the flooring materials, it may not be incredibly obvious, but, you know, somebody, a teacher may know, hey, this actually does say something and let's make it part of the curriculum. Let's kind of add it into the teaching moments of the day, and they can see what thought has been put into the spaces and made special for students, for teachers, so that they can continue to evolve and experience these spaces.
That's such a lovely detail. It kind of reminds me of when you maybe go to someone's house for a nice dinner party or something, and the table's beautifully set, and it really is all in the details. You might even notice like the little thing that they use to tie the napkin together, and just like all the thought and care and attention, like the mm-hmm. Fibonacci sequence. That's just so lovely that it would be there is another little detail coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could tell us about how you sort of got the call to be an interior designer, just, you know, in the course of not so much like your CV history, but just your own attraction to beauty in the world, to wanting to work in the space of beauty, and then also your analytical mind as well. How did that evolve for you?
Yeah, well, again, I think, you know, my knowing that I loved art and creating and math and could kind of put the pieces together led me to want to study interior design in college. I knew that I wanted to work for an architecture firm and be a designer kind of in a larger scale. I wasn't looking to be a residential designer. I knew that I wanted to kind of work in the commercial environment. And so I think I found my first drive and appreciation for how I was able to affect the users of the space when I was doing healthcare design, and designing hospitals and nurses stations, and how folks might not only appreciate their workday and be able to do their work in a better way, but also be able to experience elements that help their health journey, that help their wellness. I mean, when people visit a hospital, they're overwhelmed, they're scared, they don't know what's happening, whether they're, you know, there because they're there for a procedure or for a checkup, or they're there visiting somebody. You know, it's kind of an overwhelming experience. And so wanting to kind of make the initial experience calming and create wayfinding opportunities so they don't feel lost and overwhelmed. And being able to have those conversations with the facilities teams that are in charge of these spaces and kind of help to influence them and see how, get the information of how the users are coming into the space, but also kind of add layer upon layer of how we can make it an even better experience for them. And so then I continued on in my healthcare journey, but then found educational design. And that was when I was at Lionakis, started working in the education studio. And I think it felt like, oh, this is where I belong. This is where I need to be. My parents were both educators themselves. My dad, a college professor, and my mom, a preschool teacher. So at opposite ends of the educational journey. But I spent a lot of times at the preschool that my mom taught at and at the college that my dad was a professor. And so kind of being in the educational world for so much of my childhood and seeing good opportunities and not so good design opportunities, or, you know, the kind of furniture arrangements of a classroom where everybody is in a small desk sitting forward and facing the teacher, and then experiencing other classrooms where the teacher had pods set up or had a comfortable couch and had a little more student choice. And I think that concept has even evolved over time over my career, where flexible furnishings and student choice has grown even more. And it's really all about the teacher's comfort level with being able to allow that kind of student choice. But what an opportunity that is for my kids, and being able to kind of sit on a wobble stool and get the wiggles out while they're still able to pay attention to class, and maybe even be able to pay attention more because they are kind of getting their wiggles out while they're learning.
So it really is a full circle moment, just coming back to education, since you were steeped in that with your parents in the field. I love that you've then brought your own slant to kind of working in this field, and that you're also sort of saying you're seeing your work as a way to express beauty in a functional way, though. Like, I wouldn't have even thought about like a wiggle chair, the configuration of the room. And I think you're also sort of saying it's really about the energy that's created in the room by, you know, a room with like a bunch of different desks or something that's more open, cozy, spacious, that you're really setting the tone for the space where students are learning, children are learning of all ages.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think one of the pieces that I'm really interested in is how the environment can be an additional tool for teachers. I don't want it to, you know, kind of take away or fight. I don't want them to feel like they're fighting the tools that they've been given, and how can we help them? How can their furnishings, how can their built environment kind of support the teaching that they're trying to do, whether it's group work or lecture or inciting conversation within the class and trying to get students more comfortable talking out loud, even the quietest student, you know, really supporting students at all different need levels, and being able to kind of create a space that responds to everybody's needs.
I'm just absorbing this, and I really hope the audience is too. There is so much deep thought and care and just love that I hear you put into your work. And so I know when I go to my own kids' school, I'm going to just take a moment and appreciate all of the thought that goes into where every object is placed, the arrangement, the colors, everything, because I really hear it is a really deep way that you're holding and processing this all. In terms of your talent for beauty and just your attraction to beautiful things, and is that something that you were exposed to growing up? Is it, you know, how did you kind of discover that in your life younger, and then sort of how did that just evolve?
Mm-hmm. My mom has always is a very creative person, and I can remember she used to weave baskets when I was young and had the basket room, because that's a hobby that takes up a whole room in the house. I attended a lot of art classes as a kid, and I've still hope to find some of these art classes for my kids so they're not as into the just kind of free flow of creation of art as I was, but that, you know, I think being exposed and having that opportunity throughout my childhood was really important. My mom is now a quilter, so we have lots of her quilts. She does abstract art quilts that are amazingly beautiful and intricate. And actually, she and my son just made his first quilt last summer while he was visiting her, and he loved it. He's so proud of that quilt that he made with his grandma. But yeah, so there was a lot of art and beauty around as I was growing up.
I love that. And so it was something that sounds like you kind of got from mom predominantly, and that was something you were oriented to. And now it's being passed down to the next generation in a new way, a new innovative way. That's so cool about, you know, quilting, and that your son is getting that exposure as well.
Yeah. I certainly think, you know, similar to my spiritual journey, I think being exposed to a huge variety of experiences and opportunities is really the most important thing. Again, it's that exploration, right? I want to learn. I want to know about all of the different ways that I can experience beauty, whether it's visually or orally, or, you know, kind of being immersed in within a beautiful environment, or a beautiful story or a beautiful song. And I think kind of exposing myself and exposing my kids to as much as possible. I really appreciate that about what my parents did growing up, that they made sure we had lots of opportunities at our fingertips.
That just really leads into another musing or wondering I had is, what do you do for continued inspiration in beauty? I mean, I'm sure you get it. And like just seeing the sunset, like you told us earlier, I just wondered if there was, you know, anything you hold in mind or how you kind of keep yourself exposed to new ideas, or maybe even if you ever feel like blocked, how do you, you know, get that spark of creativity and inspiration going to continue to inspire yourself in your work?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways. I certainly feel like I really like to be outdoors, and so going for walks certainly helps, and I think that helps clear my mind as well. There's a small art gallery that's not too far from my office, so sometimes I'll go walk over there and just kind of walk through and see what's new and what's happening there. Similar to the yoga journey, I think it's just being open to whatever is available, making sure that I am taking those opportunities when they do come. Feeling like I can kind of explore whatever feels right in the moment.
That's a great one. So nature, being out in nature, which is continuous, boundless inspiration, and then taking in art. Mm-hmm. That's so good for us on so many levels. And it's a way to help us reflect on our emotions aside from sort of the aesthetic value of whatever we're taking in. Because as you know, of course, we can have big emotional reactions when we see pieces of art or in beauty and design in different mm-hmm. spaces.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly I like to surround myself with art in my home, original art and prints of art, where we do a lot of home projects as well. You might be able to see behind me that there's some unfinished wood back there. but that's one thing that my partner and I really like to work on together, is kind of continuously making decisions for what our own environment wants to be, and kind of working on that together and adding to it over time.
Well, that's such a nice way to collaborate together and mm-hmm. involve your partner in your passion as well. Do you mm-hmm. have a favorite artist or artists that you find yourself turning towards, like the prints in your home or anyone that you really are drawn to?
You know, I have a brand new piece of art right in front of me, as well as some of the art behind me that are by one of my best friends. She and I went to design school together, Laura Dunn of Mac and Lucille Art. She does these amazing abstract backgrounds, and she has an amazing eye for color as well, having been a design major. And then her story is really interesting. She grew up in her parents' greenhouse. They were florists and growers. And so she creates these beautiful, very realistic blooms and ferns from kind of that perspective as a kid, of kind of the background's blurry and abstract and bright and beautiful. And then here's this thing that I'm focusing on, this beautiful flower or fern from overhead, and kind of seeing that perspective come through, I think is really cool.
Well, that sounds amazing. And of course, now I'm dying to see this. So mm-hmm. I'll have to get the link from you so that we can put that in the description of today, along with the links to the songs.
So absolutely.
We can see more of this lovely art. That's so lovely. Before we go to jazz, I wanted to just ask you if you had any sort of kind of final thoughts or reflections on the connection between spirituality, service, especially in the capacity that you're doing it, bringing your design and knowledge of color and beauty to the educational settings, and spirituality, sort of how that all intersects, how you see the connection there.
Yeah, I think it's again, it's just something that evolves over time and feels right. I think that I'm constantly seeking out new knowledge and looking for things that inspire me. One of the ways that I'm seeking knowledge, I'm on the school board at my son's school because I want to better understand kind of the inner workings of the school and what pain points teachers have and ways that kind of I can help personally, but also that I can evolve and learn and grow as a better designer for other schools and other communities that I work with. And so I think it's kind of just that constant exploration, that constant reflection and striving for bringing all of those pieces together in the best way possible.
I love that. And I think, again, just going back to the concept that we've kind of gotten from you, there's like a striving and an exploring and a holding. And yet I'm hearing there, it's not forced. It's just, it's like something that you're sort of saying you really kind of follow and go with what comes up organically. Like you really try to go with the flow in terms of what you're called to. And then, you know, even the work you're doing as a board member is serving your son's school. And then it's also serving it to expand your knowledge base so that you're bringing more of that when you go into a space to create and design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think any of those times where it's a give and take, right? It's, I want to learn from you so that I can help create a better experience for you. And so, you know, there's that kind of, what can you help me with so that I can then take that in and consider it and give it back in a way that kind of makes your experience better or makes more than just your experience better, right? I think talking with clients and, you know, it's a lot of times it's administration or maintenance and facilities folks and teachers. And there are often times we don't even get to hear the student voice and how they might experience the space, but really kind of taking all of those voices and collecting them and thinking through, you know, what are the things we heard over and over and how can we then kind of create what somebody is looking for or give that back in a way that is better for everybody.
There's so much that you're thinking about and holding in terms of the work you do. And again, I am really going to take this the next time I am in an educational setting and just appreciate everything, all the thought, the detail, the care, the love and the service that goes into designing spaces for our enjoyment. Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to some jazz.
Great.
The theme of today, of course, continuing on, is beauty. And as we're learning from you, Dorothy, being in flow and harmony. And I thought for beauty, and this episode is also going to air in April, the week of the birthday anniversary of Ella Fitzgerald.
So wonderful.
We will be listening to some of Ella today. I'll give a little intro to sort of each song. Before we do, since we're kind of mid-show here, I'm going to read three more quotes for us to just kind of digest as we transition, and then I will get into the music that we are going to hear. No matter how plain a woman may be, if truth and honesty are written across her face, she will be beautiful. Eleanor Roosevelt. You are the only thing. You are a divine being, an all-powerful creator. You are a deity in jeans and a t-shirt, and within you dwells the infinite wisdom of the ages and the sacred creative force of all that is, will be, and ever was. Anthony St. Martin, Divine Living, the Essential Guide to Your True Destiny. And finally, hide yourself in God, so when a man wants to find you, he will have to go there first. Shannon L. Alder. So we'll just sit with those and we will go on to having some more inspiration in the form of beauty via Ella Fitzgerald. So the first song that we're going to hear is called Jazz Samba. And this is from a recording, Ella and Duke at the Côte d'Azur. It's a 1967 live album by Ella Fitzgerald, accompanied by the big band of Duke Ellington. And this was recorded at the Jazz à Juan Festival in Juan-les-Pins on the French Riviera between June 26th and July 29th, 1966. So let's just take a moment to appreciate the beauty even of the setting. How lovely would it be to be on the French Riviera, to be able to hear Ella Fitzgerald and Duke Ellington and his band. That is just like the epitome of elegance and loveliness. I just have to say that first.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. I can picture it now.
And I do just want to point out that in Duke Ellington's orchestra, he had an incredible selection of musicians that were stars in their own right, including Paul Gonsalves on the tenor saxophone, Johnny Hodges on the alto saxophone, Ben Webster on the saxophone, and Cootie Williams on trumpet. So these are just some of the players. So we are going to now listen to this. We're actually going to see the video of it from YouTube. So I'm going to put on screen share. And audiences, you're listening along with this. This is the time to sort of pause, and I'll leave the link and you can go and hear the music along with us. Okay. Well, absolutely simply marvelous. Did you get the categories of emotional listening that I sent you? Just as a little way to think about.
Should I pull those up?
Yeah, I can pull them up too on the screen. So what was your experience like just taking in this piece? Just your thoughts, feelings, emotions, memories, just whatever you noticed.
Yeah, well, certainly watching Ella perform, it is joyful, right? She is just having a great time up there. You can feel the energy. It's hard to not want to move and dance. I can't imagine how all those folks sitting in the audience were just kind of sitting there. You want to get up and really dance with her. And she just has kind of this uninhibited feeling about her that is so contagious. Like, it really wants me to just join in and kind of move and dance, and hearing her scat is so cool.
Absolutely. What would you like, what category of emotional listening would you put this song in? Or maybe there's a couple of them. And again, if you guys are listening along with us, there's no right answers. It's totally subjective. It's just, it could be many things, you know?
Yeah. Emotional elevation certainly makes me feel better when I listen to her. Emotional galvanization. You know, like, I want to get up and dance. I want to be right there. I want to enjoy the experience with her and with everybody in the audience. emotional tone setting. She certainly creates a really cool vibe, and kind of when she is scatting and mimicking the drums at the end and kind of getting quieter and quieter, you know, it's like, oh, what's going to come next? And then her burst of loud, joyful song comes afterwards. And even her chuckles, you know, she's really having a good time as she's up there. It certainly makes me think a little bit about emotional justice and what was probably going on in the world at the time, especially for her and Duke Ellington, and how, you know, despite kind of the challenges that they're probably facing in their everyday life and their you know, racial injustice and all of those experiences happening in the world at the time, that they're still making sure to kind of have this moment of joy and be able to share that with others.
That's such a good point. And it is so incredible that jazz as an art form, especially, was birthed, you know, from the time of Jim Crow and, you know, slavery as its roots, and then all through continued racism and Jim Crow laws, that this is when jazz thrived. It was in spite of it. And it was so many of these artists' ways of using their experience in pain and creating something absolutely exceptional. And jazz is recognized as an international art form. And it's also interesting too, this was a recording date from France. Many jazz artists, you may or may not know, especially Black artists, they toured and performed in Europe for many years. And Europe was less racist than the United States, and there was also a great appreciation for the art form. And so it was almost like a little bit of a respite or a place where they could go, and it was, you know, more pleasant to live, and people were deeply appreciative of your art. So I always say, like, thank you to our European brothers and sisters for their embrace of art, especially the French. They get it at the deep soul level.
Yeah.
I was really struck in this performance too by Jimmy Jones, the pianist. He just kind of had this look on his face at one point of like complete awe of Ella when she just like had total command of her scatting, and she brought it, she started really big and she brought it down low, and he just looked at her. It was just like the most beautiful look of admiration. Mm-hmm. I also really got a vibe that was very like sensual, almost sexual in a way, like she was just so fully embodied. It's just this beautiful woman up singing, and, you know, jazz really is everything in life. It's our joys, our ecstasies, our sexuality. It definitely mm-hmm. sort of has that vibe.
Yeah. You know, listening to her and kind of just watching her scat, and how incredible it is to just be able to kind of go with exactly what you're feeling from within and let it come out of your body, and, you know, where that point is within her, right? It really feels like she's just kind of bringing us all in and letting us experience really this very inside part of her, this very vulnerable part of her but she just does it with such ease and smoothness and joy that it, you know, you feel like she has, like you said, command of everything, of her voice, of the room, of the experience.
I found myself wanting to kind of like borrow that just embodied sensuality and her comfortableness, or like her sense of just being at ease in her own skin, you know, like just being at the beach, being relaxed, just completely being yourself. I found myself like yearning for this feeling that she really communicated to us, because that is what makes people attractive. It's when we're authentic. It's not like some prepackaged beauty standard or whatever that the media and society keeps telling us that we need to achieve, which just makes everybody, including me, feel terrible. You know, it's just like when we're just fully ourselves, that is the most beautiful. I would also put this in the category of emotional galvanization and emotional tone setting, because I also felt that urge to kind of get up and dance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go to our second song. This is going to be a little bit of a slower ballad, and we are going to hear April in Paris, which is very apropos because, as I mentioned, this episode will air the week of the birthday anniversary of Ella Fitzgerald in April. And what a lovely way to bring in spring as we're entering this spring season. Now, this is a studio album that was recorded by Ella and Louis, and it was also accompanied by the Oscar Peterson Quartet. And Oscar Peterson, as you may or may not know, is one of the greatest jazz pianists of all time. So this was kind of like getting two masters already, Ella and Louis Armstrong. And then Oscar Peterson in and of himself is just like a major star. So it was like everything aligned. And this was the first of three albums that they did together. So let us hear April in Paris. Well, simply beautiful. What was your experience of hearing April in Paris?
Yeah, this is the kind of music that I will play in the evenings when we're cooking dinner and just wanting to kind of bring the tone down a little bit and dance in the kitchen, you know, kind of just enjoy those moments. And it really felt like we were kind of, you know, listening in to that moment between Ella and Louis Armstrong, that they were really kind of whispering to each other and sharing a moment between the two of them. I certainly think that there was a lot of mood setting for me personally because of that kind of, here's the time that I usually listen to this kind of music and want to kind of feel that slowness, that kind of reprieve at the end of the day, the chaotic day, and just be able to kind of enjoy the moment with my family. So it's certainly some emotional dwelling for me, and emotional tone setting for sure when life feels really chaotic and wanting to play something that you can just take a deep breath and calm down.
That's so lovely, just the way that you have the association to being with your family at the end of the day, that hearing the music, which is kind of, as you mentioned, a moment of intimacy between the two of them, then can create that warm, safe, like intimacy in the family for your family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of times it's, you know, me and my partner dancing in the kitchen, enjoying that moment together and the kids seeing us and, you know, seeing that we do have loving moments between each other. And I think that it also creates a sense of calm for them, right? Knowing that they do have a safe environment and a safe home to be in.
And letting them see the love that flows between the two of you. That's mm-hmm. wonderful. Mm-hmm. This brought up a lot of emotion for me. I teared up a little bit and I had a difficult interaction with a family member and over the last day or so. And I think hearing this music, oh, I'm going to cry. I think it just reminded me just to like, let the love flow, you know, like, because that to me is what this song is about. It's just kind of like letting this love flow between two people, to yourself coming out. So I think I definitely have some repair work to do, as we mentioned at the beginning of the hour, that you often try to do. And I also just felt like a deep sense of gratitude, you know, to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly kind of pulls you in, right? It makes you feel comforted and can kind of bring up things, whether you know they're harboring there or not, but to be able to kind of feel that feel that warm hug from the song, from the music.
Yeah, that's what it was. And so I think I feel inspired now. Maybe I'll put this in a category of emotional galvanization to go do the repair work that I need to do. And of course, it's just like, that's really what we're here for. We're here to give and receive love in all the capacities that we can to our children and to our romantic partners and the work we do. And I think I really needed to hear that. And thank you for your comment. But what you just said to me, it felt almost like what a therapist would say, but in like a very loving way. It felt like you were giving me a hug there. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we are going to close out our jazz listening today with a very upbeat tune. And that is Ella Fitzgerald at the 1967 recording from when she is in Germany. She is singing Mack the Knife. It's from an album called Ella in Deutschland. And this album became famous because when Ella started to sing the song, she had been performing for a while and she forgets the lyrics to Mack the Knife. And as we know, she knows how to scat. And so she just scats the life out of this song and ends up subsequently winning a Grammy for this performance. So I thought there was some really great just spiritual teaching in this song, that stuff happens in life that we absolutely cannot anticipate. Sometimes the stuff that we don't want to have happen, and there's really a choice. We either embrace it and sort of ride that wave, or, you know, we choose not to. And so I thought, like, what better way than to hear Ella scat and just go with that. So let us hear our final song for today. All right. Well, I got the date wrong, I have to say. So this was 1960, Ella in West Berlin. So we also see Ella as an ambassador for democracy while Berlin was separated into East and West Berlin. Wow. Okay, Dorothy, what came up for you with this marvel that we just experienced?
Yeah, well, immediately the song reminded me of playing in the pep band in high school, because we would certainly play this song. And so I was, you know, kind of thinking about, oh, this song has been just shared throughout generations and generations, and even, you know, Ella's rendition of it and her kind of, as she goes off and forgets the words and reminds us that, oh yeah, these other folks have recorded this song too, and now I'm sharing my own version of it, and kind of just that forever sharing of the tune and of the song and how familiar it is, even if you don't necessarily know what that song is, probably heard the tune somewhere. So kind of experiencing it in the bigger picture, I thought was pretty cool.
When you were in high school, which version of Mack the Knife were you guys listening to?
Well, so we were playing for pep band. So we would play at the basketball games and such. I played the flute in the band. And it was also bringing up some memories of, you know, I probably wasn't playing it perfectly, but, you know, if you get kind of the main tune down, if you get kind of the main vibe down, then with that many people, you know, there's probably between 25 and 50 of us on any given night in the band. And with that many people, you can kind of just overall create the mood and the feeling without it having to be perfection, which I think is kind of cool too, of Ella's version of, we're just going to go for this and see what comes out. And hey, it turned out pretty good.
I love that. So it really takes you back to, it sounds like being in the band was also just a time to be joyful and kind of just like, you know, similar to how you told us you used your voice, let the beauty just come out in a really kind of a bullying way, what categories would you put this song into?
I definitely thought of emotional innovation. We're experiencing something new, right? This song was never sung that way before. And a lot of Ella's music, right? That it is sung that way one time by her, and every time she sings it, it may be different. And even though it is a familiar song and has been recreated by endless people, right? People singing it, people playing it, high school pep bands recreating it. It's certainly a new version every single time it comes.
I agree. I love that. You know, she starts off by singing the lyrics, kind of improvising, and then she scats. She just kind of really takes it to where she needs to go with it. And again, I just found myself hearing this song and just deeply admiring her embrace of the moment and just her authenticity. And I think there's something in me that is really yearning to be as authentic as I can, because I know there can be ways that I will hold myself back or think I need to sort of be a certain way in different settings. And just, I think the message that I'm really taking away from hearing the music ministry of Ella, we'll call it, is just being able to really be authentic, and then tying it back to beauty and perfection, what you've taught us today about really being able to hold in mind kind of a practice, like with your yoga, that you are interested in doing, and then just like let it flow and evolve, you know, just like kind of go with the flow. And that's really what she does with this tune. She just totally embraces and goes, lets herself go with it, and being it not perfect. And then ironically, it ends up winning a Grammy because it's just so cool and all encompassing.
Yeah, it's all about exploring, right? At the end of the day, it's all about her exploring where the music takes her, where the scatting goes, where the moment, how she feels in that moment and what comes up for her. And I think, you know, there's a lot we can take away from that, of making sure that we are kind of being in the moment and experiencing life as it comes and building off of that.
I was also thinking about just, you know, we're both mothers, and I know even with my own kids, I can get caught up kind of in like the day to day, or I need to do this and that sometimes when I'm with them, and I really can take myself too seriously. And I also want to borrow, in addition to authenticity, just the spirit of being more playful. Like, because there's so many moments that pass where I'm like, gosh, I really could just like let this go, or just kind of make things more playful. And it's such a good feeling in our bodies to do that. And so that's another thing I want to kind of gently hold in mind without being overly rigid or perfectionistic about it.
Absolutely. The struggle, the balance.
Well, we are just about time to wrap up. Before we do, for every guest on this show, I ask them this question to end. There is a Buddhist concept of what's called a dedication of merit. At least this is how it was explained to me. I'm not Buddhist. However, I enjoy like some of the meditations and practices. I'm very eclectic in my spiritual beliefs. I really would say I'm a mystic. Like, I'm for God in many different capacities. And the concept of the dedication of merit, from what I understand, is that for the work you did today, Dorothy, just coming here, letting us know about your life, your passions, your just sharing of yourself, and for the work you did, you can choose to dedicate that to a loved one in your life, or it could be a cause out in the world that is happening, you know, just for your open-heartedness today and your vulnerability and sharing of yourself. What would you like to dedicate just, you know, the work you did today to, in your dedication of merit?
That's such a lovely question. And the thing that's coming up for me is just thinking about all of those that I can touch in any situation that I'm in, and kind of help their life experience grow better, whether it's the students and teachers in the classrooms that I'm helping to create, or my kids and my family, and kind of helping them experience more joy and a better life through all of the experiences that I bring to the table. I think that's really what it is how to help others. How can I help others seek that great life experience?
Well, maybe I hear you saying too that your dedication to merit is kind of like for everyone that you will continue to serve. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. For me today, I think I will go with the family member that I mentioned that I need to repair with. And I've also been thinking about the war in Ukraine as it approaches the 2-year anniversary, or it just passed recently, that is still going on. There's also Israel and Gaza, of course. However, I've really been just holding this in my heart. So I just hope for peace in my heart, since it starts at home and then all around the world. So it's just been an absolute pleasure, Dorothy. I can't thank you enough.
Yeah, thank you. I'm excited to hear the end result of all of this.
And to our audience, thank you for being with us and also bearing with kind of the wonkiness of having to stop and then go listen to the song and come back. I really hope that you guys got something out of this and may jazz therapy soothe your soul.